Friday, 8 to 9 a.m. So we implore you to support that would support you right now in the form of Democracy Now! 800-222-9739, WPFWFN.org, $1,000 to go, folks. We can do this together even now with a minute left. We can still do this. Become a sustaining member at the $10, $20, $50, $100 level, whatever is in your wallet and your heart to give. 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org. Let's keep the calls coming as we move to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. You are in tune to your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Tony Gentry. Tony Gentry is a writer and professor emeritus in occupational therapy at Virginia Commonwealth University. He's also the author of The Night Doctor of Richmond. How are you doing today, Tony?
Doing well. Thank you for having me.
Well, you're joining us as we're having our fundraising here at WPFW. And I'll be encouraging people to call 202-588-9739. That's 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. And we're going to try to raise $500 this morning. And I think that many of our listeners, Tony, will be very interested in your book. And I want to begin because I have a book here. And you have on the cover, you have a picture of Chris Baker. Briefly tell us who Chris Baker was.
I think of Chris Baker as the most famous Richmond, Virginia person that no one has heard of. In his day, he was notorious as the grave robber for the Medical College of Virginia. In his old age, he readily admitted to robbing hundreds of graves, always from black cemeteries in the city of Richmond, in order to provide what they called, hard to say this, but anatomy material for the student doctors who were learning to do their work at the Medical College of Virginia.
You know, we're getting ready for Halloween. So right. I don't know if this is the appropriate show. But, you know, I was curious as to how you came across his story, because your book, The Night Doctor of Richmond, is what you describe as a biographical novel.
Right, right. Yeah. So Chris Baker's story disappeared after his death. The robbing of graves was no longer necessary for anatomy classes because of the laws that were passed that allowed you to donate your body for that purpose. And then what happened was back in 1994, some years ago, during the excavation for a medical building across the street from the old Egyptian building where Chris Baker had done his work, a well was dug up, and in that well were body parts. The Virginia Commonwealth University allowed the building to stop for 2 days. Some of those body parts were removed. They were examined at the Smithsonian, and it was found that most of them were African-American people, some children, men and women both. And it was discovered at that point that these were body parts that had been left over remains from anatomy classes at the old medical school. Who did this? How did this happen? So some research was done. And it was discovered that there was a fellow named Chris Baker who was on salary as the custodian, or sometimes called the servant, for the medical doctors, for the professors at the school. And his job was to manage anatomy material, which meant he went out to the cemeteries when there had been a freshly dug grave, brought that body back to the basement of the Egyptian building, prepared it for dissection, participated in the dissection of the bodies, and then disposed of the remains, we think, in a pit underneath the building. Horrible, terrifying thing, a real atrocity. Defilement of bodies is something that every religion in the world gets upset about. Everyone is unhappy with that. Nevertheless, once that happened, it was in the news for a few weeks, and that died out. I'm telling this story in sort of a long version because I want to give credit to the people who are due to credit. In 2011, there's a wonderful professor here at VCU that whom you may know. His name is Sean Utsi. He's the chair of the African American Studies Department here. He's also a psychology professor and a documentarian. He researched this story and made a documentary called When the Well Runs Dry about the defilement of Black bodies in the from the cemeteries in this era, and highlighted this character, Chris Baker, as the culprit. Mm-hmm. So again, Chris Baker's in the news. Mm-hmm. This really caused a stir in the whole community here in Richmond, to the point that the Virginia State Legislature, about, I guess it's 10 years ago now, actually issued a proclamation of atonement saying, this happened at VCU, at the Medical College of Virginia, and there's this character, Chris Baker, who was responsible. None of the professors who were involved in this, none of the administrative staff were mentioned in this proclamation. Only Chris Baker was listed. He took the blame for it all. Finally, to answer your question.
I'm listening. This is fascinating.
As a professor at VCU, I was a part of an initiative to set up an organization called the VCU Health Hub on Church Hill in a traditionally African-American community a few years ago. And we did an onboarding session for that community activity. And in that onboarding session, we were taught that the African-American community in Richmond has mixed feelings about the medical college and the hospital itself for a variety of number of reasons. But the primary culprit, once again, was this character, Chris Baker. And in the onboarding, a woman talked to us who said that her grandmother, as she was growing up, would always tell her, come in before it gets dark or Chris Baker will get you. Mm-hmm. And the thought was, if you stay out after dark, this character is going to come bop you on the head and drag you back to the medical school.
You know, when you say that, I remember, I think the book is Night Riders by Glass Marie Fry. Mm-hmm. And there was this the stories around Howard University Med School that, you know, don't be out at night because people would be snatched up.
Yeah.
By people from the hospital and taking it for, you know, and that's part of like folklore. But, you know, I guess it is some sense in terms of facts.
The Medical College of Virginia was, you know, a big Southern college, like as it is now at the time. And Baker was sending bodies to other medical schools that he was collecting here in Richmond. But by the same token, anywhere there was a medical school, there was a need for those bodies. Mm-hmm. And there were characters like Baker who were doing this work.
Right. Well, let's turn to your book, The Night Doctor of Richmond. Your book takes us from 1857 to 1919. And you begin your book by writing about Billy Baker, the father of Chris. Talk about him, the skills he possessed, and what decisions he had to make after the Civil War.
Thank you. I appreciate you starting there. I'm an occupational therapist. And as an occupational therapist, what we care about is how people do things. And I love to read books that include descriptions of how work gets done. So in writing this book, I had to think about what Billy, being an anatomy material manager, and his son to
That's
do
an
that.
Interesting title.
Yeah. How do you go about doing that? What's the most efficient way to break into a grave? How do you cover up a grave in such a way that you can't easily break into it? How do you manage the remains of a dissection class so that you get rid of the body? Those kinds of very gruesome things were the nature of their essential work at the medical college. So that's what I tried to learn as I was writing this. And his job, as his son's job was all those parts of managing these defiled bodies.
But you know what I found interesting in your book, looking at as far as Billy Baker, is that here was an example of an African American who had a skill,
yeah,
And I was wondering how that skill was obtained.
Yeah, and I mean, and this is all conjecture because there's no record of any of this. But Billy Baker lived in the basement of the medical college, the old Egyptian building here in Richmond. His son did as well. He was called a custodian. So part of his job was doing the custodial work that we're all familiar with. Somebody had to help him learn how to do all this. And my thinking is, because this happened at the University of Virginia and other places, there was always a low-level professor, a doctor, who was called the demonstrator for anatomy classes, and their job was to obtain bodies and manage them. So no white professor doctor is going to want to do any of that work. They're going to try to find someone else that they can pay less to get that essential work done. My thinking would be that one of these doctors, professors, took Billy Baker as an enslaved person working as a custodian in the building and said, "Could you help me with this?"
Well, let me mention something else. I remember, I think it was in the construction industry, and it was blacks were kept out of the unions. And there was a one guy, I think he wanted to operate like the heavy equipment. And what happened? He would come to work early and just observe, and learn by looking and watching, as opposed to somebody actually teaching him.
And I mean, the Egyptian building is a small building. It's four stories, but it's not a big building. And there's no way that Billy Baker or Chris Baker could have avoided being a part of all that. And I'm certain that the white professors were really happy to pass this along to someone else to get that work done. And I think, I mean, as I write it, and I'm surmising, Billy Baker was quite skilled at this, and his son learned to do that as well. And one of the things that I really love about this character, Chris Baker, and his father as well, Sean Utsi, when I was talking to him about his documentary and who this character was, he said, Chris Baker was a very intelligent, skilled person. And I think, and I'll never forget him saying this, he said, if he lived today, he'd probably be a neurosurgeon. Except in his life, however, he was the most reviled person, despised person in the
Yeah,
city.
we're going to talk about that. I hope our listeners are listening to your comments, and hopefully they'll call in as during this fundraiser. The number here to call the station, as you're listening to Tony Gentry talk about his book, The Night Doctor of Richmond, the number here at the station is 202-588-9739, 202-588-9739, or 1-800-222-9739. Before I invite Katia to join us, Tony, I want to go back to looking at how, when you're talking about Billy Bark, you're talking about like the Civil War, and when I think of the Civil War and the photographs that's come out of the Civil War, or the whole thing in terms of people, soldiers being, their legs being chopped off, and the bodies, war body graves, mass graves and things of that sort. It seems that this is where this is picking up, that the war is giving rise to the advancement of anatomy and medical sciences because there's a need to deal with the soldiers.
That's all true. And one of the things that struck me in thinking about the training of doctors during the Civil War, there wasn't a whole lot of training available because so many doctors were needed. And at the Medical College of Virginia, that was the only college in the South that continued to train doctors throughout the 4 years of the war. And one of the young doctors later wrote that he was sent out into the field doing complex amputations and other heavy medical treatments night and day on the battlefield after not having even learned how to lance a boil because they were needed so quick, so much, and so fast. And the city of Richmond was, to a large extent throughout the war, one giant hospital. There were 22 hospitals in the city of Richmond during that time, treating thousands of soldiers, many of whom didn't survive. And they were there. So there's also thousands of buried soldiers in our cemeteries here.
Well, you know, we have many listeners to our station this morning, and Katia, I invite you to join us and introduce yourself to Tony.
Yes, good morning, Tony. I am just riveted to this conversation. It's pretty amazing. And I as you all were speaking, I went and read the synopsis of your book, and it's just fascinating. I really it's taken my breath away, quite frankly. So I'm not sure what else to say, except I cannot wait to read the book. I will want to say we want to thank Marcus out of Deerwood, Maryland, for getting us started this morning. Thank you so much, Marcus, for your generous pledge of support. You know what to do, folks, for E. Ethelbert Miller and the fantastic program that he produces every Thursday morning at 9 a.m. on the margin. If you are, what was my term last week? A literary, I didn't say literary fan. I can't remember the term that you laughed at,
I'm
but if
laughing
you,
now.
I know, if you're like me and you love literature and you love the work of Ethelbert Miller and all of the diverse authors and poets that he presents to us, then it's your turn to support that which supports you. 800-222-9739, $440 to go for our fall pledge drive on the margin. This is our second opportunity to come to you during this pledge drive. And we ask you to move to the phone or to the computer to make that pledge of support. You make everything here possible. You certainly provide the platform where we can hear the excellent program On the Margin, hosted by Ethelbert Miller. So we don't want to take another moment away from this conversation. I want to hear what happens next to Billy and Chris. It really is fascinating history. And I just learned last night from another book that John Brown's body was, I mean, I'm sorry, Nat Turner's body was skinned and cannibalized. So, you know, the things you learn at WPFW are magnificent. And it's really a university of the air. And to this morning is no exception to that with this author. So please go to the phones, make that call that makes the difference. 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org. A modest lift right now of $440 to meet the goal. Ethelbert.
Okay, I think we're back talking to Tony Gentry. Tony, I was wondering in terms of the writing of this book, how does one turn facts into fiction? And I say that in terms of one, when I look at your book, it's like the city of Richmond, it's medical history, it's relationship that people have to the there's just so many things happening here that now you say, okay, I'm not just a journalist reporting on this, I'm going to write a novel. And so I'm just wondering about, for our listeners, who are writers, how did you do that? And also you're navigating the issues of race.
I mean, those are big questions. But I think I have a straightforward answer for this particular book. During his lifetime, there were eight newspapers in the city of Richmond, daily newspapers. Black newspapers, white newspapers. There's a Jewish newspaper. There are all sorts of different ethnic newspapers in the city, and most of them wrote at one time or another about Chris Baker, because he was a fairly notorious, strange character. Eventually, became a legendary character in the city. A lot of contradictions in these articles. A lot of fantastic. Made up stuff about them, but there were some consistencies across them about his life. And at the same time, the medical college keeps a has a very good archive of things like payment ledgers, letters by from students, those kinds of things. And he's mentioned over and over again in the archive. So what I had to do was try to piece together what is known about him, and there's a finite amount of material that's known about him, and what that leaves is a lot of gaps. And inside those gaps is where I began to imagine, as best I could, what this gentleman might have lived, what his experience might have been. And to give you an example, we know we believe that he was married. There's some papers say he was not married, but there is a record in at Medical College that shows that he had a wife named Martha, and for a while the two of them actually worked as servants at the medical college, and that they had a son named John. So we had that material. There were papers, some of the papers say that she had a home in the Jackson Ward, which was the prominent black neighborhood in Richmond, and that Baker then lived in the basement all the time. So I had that material. There's a gravestone that seems to be her gravestone that's been found. His has never been found. But we do know when he died, because when he died, it was a front page news in all the papers in town. So as using this example, when I thought, well, what would their romance have been like? And I mean, you're America's great writer of romance. And I don't mean romance novels. I mean, love story. How do you express love? And I was thinking about your poems when I was putting this together, because I was trying to tell a story that humanized this quotes monster. And one beautiful way to humanize someone is to tell the story of a romance. And so most of the story about Baker and his wife was put together between my ears, because that was the biggest gap in his tale. And the other reason I wanted to tell about their relationship, in addition to wanting to humanize him, was probably Richmond, Virginia's most famous person is Maggie Lena Walker, the African-American businesswoman. And I wanted to include her and honor her because they were contemporaries. She grew up across the street from the Egyptian building. And by incorporating her as a friend of his wife, I was able to tell that side of Richmond's history as well. But I have to be completely honest, I made that all up.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, one of the things that seems to be very symbolic is the Egyptian building, you know, because you think of mummies, you know.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering, to what extent did you explore that building as a character?
Yeah, from day one, that building was a big character in the book. And I don't know if you've ever seen it, that building, but I tried to imagine it when it was being built in 1845. There weren't very many, I don't know that there were any four-story buildings in Richmond at that time. And it's on top of one of Richmond's prominent hills. Richmond is a city of seven hills, and the downtown hill is where the Egyptian building sits. It's above the Capitol building, further down the hill. And so, like you just mentioned, you know, Egypt was just becoming known around the world because Napoleon had conquered Egypt at the turn of the century. And to build a building that looked like an Egyptian sarcophagus, knowing about, as you said, mummies, the whole death cult of Egypt, right. The fact that, you know, this is an African place that we're talking about. It must have been a terrifying building to look at, especially.
Or there must have been some secret.
What's going on inside?
There must have been some secret masons involved. With, you know,
yeah.
Some little rituals were going on upstairs.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people marched on that building. Mm-hmm. People tried to burn that building down. It was considered. People wouldn't go near that building at night, all because of this legend of this character, Chris Baker, and what was going on in that building. To this day, I have friends who work in the building, mm-hmm. because it's still an active part of the medical school, and they will tell you that no one stays in that building after dark.
This is where my second reference to Halloween's coming up.
Yeah,
people will be staying away from the building. But on a serious note, what I was impressed by. And you really didn't address it, Tony. I was curious to how you navigated issues of race, because what happens is that I was looking at the language in terms of conversation,
yeah.
and it didn't seem as if you were trying to stereotype or capture. It just seemed that you said, okay, this is how I'm going to have people talk, as opposed to trying to capture how they might have talked back then.
This is such a huge issue for any writer, and I think especially as a white writer trying to write black dialect or black conversation, whether it's contemporary or historical, that's a whole can of worms that's so hard to play with. And I talk to friends of mine who are writers, who are black writers, and try to get a sense of what would work and what wouldn't work and what might be considered appropriation or what might be considered, right. In some way dissing somebody. And What I tried to do was, as you said, speak the way someone might typically converse, but there are differences in the way people talk. The white professors talk in a sort of high flown a speech that I imagine people in the Victorian era spoke like, white folks. Baker might have spoken exactly that same way because he lived among white people. But at the same time, I wanted him to sound casual. And I understood, I'm thinking about Everett's James and the way that James schools people on how you have to talk in some kind of vernacular or white people don't want to hear what you have to say. And probably Baker played that. There's a time when he speaks at the bidding of the professor in the book where the professor actually says, yeah, he's speaking in that vernacular and our people really love that. But whether Baker did that or not, we don't know. In the newspaper articles that were written about him, though, it's horrible.
Right. Well, you know, one of the things I commend, this is your first novel.
No, I've written another novel.
Okay. I was wondering about that because what happens is that I said the writing of this is really good. Okay.
Well, thank you.
See, you're not making reference to the other novel. That's why I thought this was like a standalone book. But let me go back to something before we take a little break. I want to go back because you have it in your in the back of this book. A lot of information comes from newspapers, and in this case, black newspapers. And I'm looking at it in terms of just how black newspapers are very key to documenting the Negro baseball leagues, you know, because somebody's covering some. But then there's always this gap. There's also the thing in terms of it can we accept it as fact? Or is this, to what extent does a certain degree of folklore come into the reporting or rumors or gossip that now, because it's in a newspaper, it's presented as fact, but it's just basically was a story that just circulated in the community? So how do you navigate that?
Yeah, the old newspapers, the 19th century newspapers, didn't necessarily follow the we need two sources in order to
write. Exactly.
You know, and what a colorful character like this really lended himself to mythology, legend, all sorts of crazy writing and ideas. But I'll tell you, it seemed to me, reading the sources, the white newspapers went into more of that, let's make up some crazy stories, than the black newspapers, which were one of the Richmond Planet was a famous nationwide, well-known newspaper in the 19th century. John Mitchell Jr., one of the great early civil rights advocates, was the editor of that paper. And when he wrote about Chris Baker, he wrote about him as a person who was hired by the Medical College of Virginia to rob graves. He didn't go into any of that, you know, let's scare people. He wanted it to stop. And he named names and he wanted people to know he's doing this, but he's the hand in it all. The reason for he's doing this is because he's been paid to do it by these white people. And let's make this clear. So I trusted the black newspapers in some ways more than the white ones in pulling this story together.
Well, I'm going to go back to when you gave this, you handed this book to me. I'm struck by the photo, even if I didn't know who Chris Baker was, I'm struck by the photo.
Okay.
And I'm looking at African-American photos in which people like pose, you know, like, for example, you know, if you look at Frederick Douglass wanted to present himself a certain way. So despite all the rumors that might be circulating in the community, Chris Baker seemed like he wanted to make a statement in this photograph. So why don't you just describe this photograph to our listeners? Because, you know, this is radio. They can't see the book that I'm holding up here.
Yeah, right. So this photograph was taken when Chris Baker was about 60 years old. He lived to be 70. So he doesn't look like an old man, but he's getting on. He's been doing this job his whole life. And he's posed sitting in a chair on the stoop of the Egyptian building. You can see part of one of the columns of the building in the corner. He is sitting there holding in his hands a skull and a femur bone as if he's going to play them like a drum. And he's not staring at the camera. He's sort of looking off in the distance with this sort of wistful look. It's a fascinating look to me. It's something that really struck me the whole time I was writing the book. His face is so lonely and soulful and sad, And it's just a remarkable photograph to me. He's showing you that this is what I do. I'm holding in my hands what I do. No one else can do this. And I can't really share what I do with anyone else. So that to me is what that photograph says.
You know, you could probably take this photograph and compare it to a number of old blues musicians, you know, where their face captures, you know, maybe the floods that they've witnessed, the deaths, you know, just a hard life. But at the same time, you know, they're dealing with life and they've seen death, you know. And so I was looking at that. I felt it was a very strong photograph. I was wondering, as a writer, before we take our break, do you go back and look at this picture and say, okay, I'm writing about this, let me put this picture in front of me while I'm typing to remind myself who I'm writing about?
Absolutely. And there are several historic photographs of Chris Baker. Each one adds to that sense of who that person was. Mm-hmm. And to a large extent, I worked from those photographs in imagining him. And I don't know if you recall this, but in the very beginning of the book, as a little boy, he picks up a skull and a femur bone, right, and taps them. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the book, this happens to him again. And the reason for that is that photograph. It opens the book and it closes the book.
Okay, well, we're gonna take a little break. So we'll close off the first half of the show and open up the second half. I'm talking to Tony Gentry, and we're talking about his book, The Night Doctor of Richmond. We're here at WPFW doing our fundraising period, and we're encouraging people to call 202-588-9739, 202-588-9739, or 1-800-222-9739. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station is WPFW 89.3 FM.
The DC Palestinian Film and Art Festival is back in person for the first time in 6 years. There has never been a more critical time to honor stories created by Palestinians from historic Palestine and around the world. This year's festival featured the DC premiere of 6 films, including From Ground Zero, a collection of 22 short films made by Palestinian filmmakers in Gaza since October 7th, and it's Palestine's official submission to Academy Awards. The festival will also host a hands-on workshop to create your own political art, conversation with filmmakers and artists, and the DC book launch of Visualizing Palestine First Book. Details at dcpfaf.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back on The Margin with my guest, Tony Gentry, the author of The Night Doctor of Richmond. Tony, talk about Dr. Stuart McGuire and why he's important in your book.
Yeah, Stuart McGuire is the son of Hunter Holmes McGuire. So most of what we're talking about is Hunter Holmes McGuire. Hunter Holmes McGuire was a Civil War surgeon. He was born in Winchester, Virginia, was part of the very early battles in the Civil War that were around Winchester, and became the corps surgeon for the army that Stonewall, the famous Stonewall Jackson, his army. And even before his fame for that, he was locally famous because after John Brown's raid, and it became clear that there was going to be some huge break in the United States around slavery, he and 200 other Virginian medical students were studying in Philadelphia, which had the best medical school in the country at the time. He brought all of them back as sort of a assistant professor, all of them back to Richmond all at once on one train, feted with a huge parade. And they then went to the Medical College of Virginia and were trained as doctors for free in order to get ready for this war that was coming on. After the war, just to give an example of what the work was like for a Civil War surgeon, he was lecturing some years later about anesthesia. And he said that during the war, he had conducted 40,000 6,000 surgeries using the anesthesia of the time, which is mind-boggling to think about. He came back to the Medical College of Virginia, worked as a doctor in the community, became the president of the American Medical Association, started his own competing college down the street, opened a hospital here in Richmond. And when he died, there was a basically 3 days of mourning for this heroic doctor at a time when the white people of Richmond were beginning more and more to talk about the lost cause and consider all the leaders of the Civil War on the Confederate side as heroes.
Mm-hmm. You know, one chapter that I felt was extremely important, Tony, was chapter 38, the College of Physicians and Surgeons, Richmond, where you write about this new age of medicine beginning. Could you talk about that?
Yeah. So the 19th century is when medicine around the world, starting in Europe and then in the United States, went from using herbs and bleedings and all sorts of what we consider primitive treatments into a more modern style of medicine. For instance, during the Civil War in the 1860s, there was no idea of disinfectant. So a doctor would move from one patient to another without even washing his hands. Mm-hmm. The way you treated a wound in the 1860s was to pour cold water on it. Nevertheless, people survived sometimes. Over time, though, anesthesia came online, and the interest that I had was how do you preserve a dead body, because that's what Baker was concerned with.
Right.
So refrigeration began. So electrical refrigeration comes online. Formaldehyde as a pickling agent comes online.
Right.
Embalming is something that begins to happen. And all this happens in the second half of the 19th century and changes the way doctors perform and also how undertakers perform.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, I was wondering, because this has such broad implications, but I want to get back to this thing in terms of how people began to view Chris Baker, and you sort of hint at it in your book that maybe he was a conjurer.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And then you have like his mother appearing and things gonna be being passed on. How much is that true?
I would not have gone there on my own, the large majority of newspaper articles about him, and also documents written by the professors at VCU about him, mm-hmm. talk about him as being rumored to be some kind of witch doctor and to have communication with the spirit world and to be able to both heal and harm just by looking at you. That's part of this strange legend around some, probably it will come up about anyone who handles dead bodies. He was considered a ghoul, a sort of spirit person in touch with the spirit world in that way. And I thought, let's play with that. And the way I decided to do that was have him suffer an injury early on in the book that may have scrambled his brain in some way, or that may have opened up an avenue to the supernatural that the rest of us may not have, because I wanted to include that piece that all the articles talked about. And then what I thought I would do, because so many of the people, the African Americans brought here during slavery, came from Nigeria, and they were part of the Igbo tribe. I looked into the religious practices, the traditional religious practices of that particular people, and this is an ancestor worshiping pantheistic religion. I thought, okay, I've got to find a way to bridge that into the story as well. And that's why his mom reappears. That's why there's this strange monster character. And that's why he's haunted by the spirits of all the people that he disinters.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's bring a wonderful spirit back into our conversation. Kati, are you still there?
I am, and what an introduction.
You're our spiritual advisor of how to conjure and raise money for the station.
Yeah, I don't know about that company today.
Put a spell on our listeners.
Exactly, a Nina Simone spell, that's right. Well, we still are in need of the $440, folks. I know like myself, you've been glued to this interview. You don't want to move. You just want to listen. But we need you to be active right now and pledge your support. Support that which supports you. Support the excellent work of today's interview, as well as all of the programming that E. Ethelbert Miller brings you on the margin. The number to call is 800-222-9739. Help me help Ethelbert. He just called me a conjurer, so I need to come up with something. And you can be a help in me coming up with something right now by calling 800-222-9739 or going online to WPFWFM.org. Again, $440 to go. And we still have 20 minutes. You can become a sustaining member in those 20 minutes and pledge at the $10, $20, $50, $100 level, whatever is in your heart and your wallet to pledge. Please make the call at 800-222-9739, 202-588-9739, or the click at WPFWFM.org that makes the difference. We need you now, and we come to you four times a year. This is our second week in our fall pledge drive, and we do not want to disappoint Ethelbert. He will not have me back, I guarantee it. So please,
on you.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Halloween is coming. So please do your part right now. Help us. 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org, $440 to go. We'll thank you on the other side.
Okay. Well, let me get back to Tony, the author of The Night Doctor of Richmond. Yeah, I want to expand on what I think is also the importance of this book in terms of how it helps us think about things today. In terms of, we're not talking necessarily about the stealing of bodies, but sometimes the experimentation on bodies. And I'm thinking of what happens to people who are incarcerated. I'm thinking of what happens, the stories that have emerged based on some of the indigenous schools. You know, what happens to some of the body of the young children. How can this book serve in terms of us addressing those issues? Because, you know, we're looking at people robbing graves and pauper graves, but sometimes what happens outside prisons, you know, bodies are disposed of. Looking at how even during the civil rights movement, you know, people's bodies disappeared. Yeah. And I'm just wondering about the ethical issues that this book, your book raises.
Yeah, I was trying to at the end and an afterward comment on that, and the piece that seems that most struck me was the hypocrisy around blaming Chris Baker for the work that he was doing at the behest of the medical school. The people that were to my mind most to blame for this were not Chris Baker. It was the people that paid him to do the work. Mm-hmm. And I think tracking down who is doing this work, who's benefiting from it, and who's paying for it are the questions we have to think about. Because, the whole black market in body parts that surfaces in the papers every once in a while goes on all the time. Mm-hmm. The atrocities happening to living people along those lines. You know, China especially has been notorious for robbing organs from living prisoners, and we could talk all day about some of those kinds of atrocities around the world. What do you do? Do you own your own body? What is the worth of an organ? These are just terrifying questions to think about, but actually they're things that are happening every day.
Well, I think they're not just terrifying, but they're sort of also like ethical and philosophical questions.
Yeah.
And I guess one of the questions I would ask you is in terms of what can people learn from the dead?
Yeah.
You know, and I say that in terms of one, because where our science and technology are, we can, you know, go back and look at, try to find DNA evidence and things of that sort. And all of a sudden people are making claims to people who at one time were unknown.
Right. Right. Yeah, for sure. And one of the real wonderful things that has come out of all this, when the Smithsonian took the body parts that were taken from the well back in 94 here at Medical College, they were able to identify through DNA some of the descendants of these people. And to their credit, the Medical College brought these bodies back to Richmond, and a wonderful ceremony has been held to honor them, and a sort of a ceremony of atonement as well, with their descendants coming to be part of this ceremony. So to me, it's wonderful that this kind of thing can happen because of DNA, and that I think has been a part of what's going on in Richmond overall over the last decade or so. There's a kind of a healing that's going on here in Richmond around recognizing our history and acknowledging it, and maybe through seeing it for the first time for real, maybe we can find a way to get along better. I've lived here a long time, and it's a powerful thing to see these cemeteries speaking back to us, these bodies speaking back to us, and our history coming back, and maybe we're beginning to face it.
Well, one of the things I feel is the challenge of facing our history is that when I read your book, all of a sudden I'm saying, okay, I've been reading about the Civil War. Okay, this is another way of looking at the Civil War. The same way, for example, you know, a number of years ago, I started looking at the Civil War through the development of photography.
Yeah.
Okay, you know, because photography is coming of age at the time the Civil War is going on. And so that's why I was really looking at Frederick Douglass and how he presented himself in images. But now what happened with your book, it opens up a whole door in terms of looking at how medicine, the medical field, is advancing, you know,
right.
That without this war, maybe, you know, it takes years for us to figure out, okay, how to preserve a body, how to deal with anesthesia, things of that sort. So, you know, you look up and says, okay, out of this tragedy, certain things are advancing. And so I look at your book and I said, wow, okay, we may not be robbing grave sites, but we're just like snatching people's kidneys and livers, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which to me is just as dangerous.
Right.
It becomes a market.
Yeah. And I always tell my students that horrible thought, but it medicine always advances in wartime. Mm-hmm. For instance, the idea of an intensive care unit came online during the Vietnam War. And now every community hospital has an intensive care unit. So the idea of using a helicopter to bring someone to a hospital was a Vietnam War innovation. And so you see these kinds of things. And now from the Afghanistan-Iraq conflicts that we hope are done, we've learned all sorts of things around prosthetics and managing brain injuries. That's an unfortunate benefit of war.
I was wondering to what extent your book would be part of someone's curriculum, like say, for example, in medical school, you know, because I remember, I mean, at Howard, there was a number of people who were saying, okay, I want to make sure that my students have access to books about traditional medicine and healing,
yeah.
just so that,
yeah.
you know, it complements, you know, what we're teaching here in our curriculum. And I just feel that this book would be very important for medical students, you know, not necessarily history students.
I think if you're interested in where we've come from in medicine, that would be a really good topic to talk about. And I was thinking about that when I was writing it.
Mm-hmm. How do you see this book affecting, let's just begin with the state of Virginia, because what happens is that many times you uncover this history, but people prefer that it would be remained hidden.
Right.
You know, because right. what happens, sometimes you look up, it affects people's families, you know, who have the same name. And so say, okay, this is my great grandfather. And why are you looking at him as a villain now?
Yeah.
So this discovery on one level is positive, but then it also can open up scenes within a particular state or community. And you are the culprit.
right. Yeah, absolutely. You know, along the thread I was just mentioning about how we're just beginning to wake up to the lies that we've been told are lies. You know, when I was in school, I'm an old man now, but when I was in school here in Virginia in a public schools, I was taught the word slave was never used. Mm-hmm. My sons were recently graduated from high school. Slavery was talked about, but the role of Richmond, our city, as the second largest slave market in America for 50 years was not mentioned. And so there's so much we have to uncover. Maybe novels like this that try to tell sort of human interest versions of these tales, mm-hmm. Try to humanize the story, are ways to help us, as I said, begin to sort of at least see where we've been, mm-hmm. because we can't start to heal until we can see the facts.
Well, it opens the door about genres. You know, you just talk about, I mean, this is a biographical novel. I was wondering whether someone would read this book and say, okay, I'm going to write a biography, you know, of yeah. Chris Baker.
Right.
And the same way I remember Robert Hemingway had did the first biography on Zora Neale Hurston. And right. Down in Orlando, he had said, well, I think a Black woman should write, you know, a yeah. biography. And then yeah. that's where Valerie Boyd took up that mantle. And I was just wondering, maybe there might be a need for a biography. I mean, you did a lot of research in terms of newspapers and stuff, but you were still dealing with what I would call like creative nonfiction. You know, you're sort right. of imagining things.
Right.
But somebody would say, okay, I'm with new databases and things that I can follow and find more facts.
Yeah. 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 You may have read about this too. The lady who wrote, a woman had written a novel about T.S. Eliot's affair with a woman across his entire life. And it was apparently a very popular novel. And then just recently she's written a biography about that takes out all the speculation and just tells the facts. So I think you could do that with Chris mm-hmm. Baker. Mm-hmm. There are going to be gaps though. Mm-hmm. Because that's where the imagination piece comes in.
How did this book, Tony, how did this book change you, you know, in terms of, I mean, you occupational therapy, but I mean, how did this change you in terms of, you know, just looking at your profession, navigating through old documents?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know this from your own work, I'm sure. Every time you sit down to write something, you learn about yourself and you learn about the skill set. You develop your skill set. I think the most important thing for me, I've worked with people with severe disabilities, who are some of the least respected people in the country, in the world, really. And I see these people as in many cases, unsung heroes, because just the work it takes to get up in the morning and get going. Mm-hmm. And I've always been somebody, I think like you too, who sort of is on the side of the outsiders. And I don't think there could have been more of an outsider than Chris Baker. And to sit down in the morning and try to empathize with that person as he went about his day, I think it's given me a deeper understanding, and in my own mind at least, about what it must be like to be reviled, what it must be like to be disrespected. You know, I'm a white male American. I don't have that experience. The world was made for me, so to speak.
Well, one thing that you did do, you did give Chris a family. You gave him a family, you see the other side of him. So I want to thank you for that, because I think this book in some way provides a certain degree of healing. So I want to thank you, Tony Gentry, for being my guest on the margin. We're still going to try to encourage people to call 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739. Could you want to make any last statement?
I would love to. I have some folks to thank. We want to thank Jim out of Silver Spring, Maryland. Thanks so much. An anonymous out of my neighborhood, Tacoma Park, Maryland, says, love on the margin. And so do we, anonymous. Thank you for your pledge. 2:40 to go, folks. 7 minutes to do it before the collision comes your way. You can still support this fine program in the form of On the Margin, produced and hosted by E. Ethelbert Miller, like today is a prime example. 800-222-9739. WPFWFM.org.
I like how all your neighbors are anonymous.
I know, right? All the time. They don't want me to know who they are. 800-222-9739 or WPFWFM.org. 240 to go to make the goal for On the Margin. Thank you, okay, Ethelbert and Tony.
Thank you, Tony. Okay, so that's a wrap. Tony, I want to thank you very much. As once again, this is On the Margin. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The station is WPFW 89.3 FM.
Fall is a time of change and impermanence. What never changes is WPFW's unwavering commitment to providing reliable news, informative public affairs, and exceptional music that inspires both action and introspection. From October 14th through November 3rd, we celebrate The Circle Unbroken, 47 years of being in the community with WPFW during our Fall Pledge Drive. We invite you to be in community and solidarity with us by making a donation at WPFWFM.org to ensure that this independent grassroots media outlet not only survives, but thrives. It is with your generous support that we build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
The DC Palestinian Film and Arts Festival is back in person for the first time in 6 years. There has never been a more critical time to honor stories created by Palestinians from historic Palestine and around the world. This year's festival featured the DC premiere of 6 films, including From Ground Zero, a collection of 22 short films made by Palestinian filmmakers in Gaza since October 7th, and it's Palestine's official submission to Academy Awards. The festival will also host a hands-on workshop to create your own political art, conversation with filmmakers and artists, and the DC book launch of Visualizing Palestine First Book. Details at dcpfaf.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hey, Chris Garlock here.
And I'm Elise Bryant.
Tune in Thursdays at 1 p.m.
for the Labor Heritage Hour Hour.
Every week, we explore labor arts and culture.
As anarchist Emma Goldman said so famously, if I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution.
And that's how we feel about labor music, films,
theater, poetry,
labor history, labor art,
spoken word, basically anything that brings labor and the arts together.
So join us for the Labor Heritage Power Hour
here on WPFW 89.3 FM,
your station for jazz and justice.
That's the Labor Heritage Power Hour.
Thursdays from 1 to 2 p.m.
The heart and soul
of the American labor movement.
The international unites the whole darn human race.
The Kennedy Center's Let's Go There series uses opera to examine contemporary issues. In Beethoven's Fidelio, the husband suffers political imprisonment and his wife impersonates a prison guard to free him. Imprisonment and freedom will be explored in a panel discussion moderated by Nikichi Taifa, featuring Fox and Rob, the inspiring couple from the documentary Time, Danielle Cho, Washington National Opera cellist, and Charles Thornton of the DC Corrections Information Council. Acclaimed tenor Chasmin Williams Ali will also perform excerpts from Fidelio. The free event and reception will be held Wednesday, October 30th, from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at the MLK Junior Library, located at 901 G Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C.
We're back! WPFW is excited to announce the return of the Social Justice Calendar, your go-to weekly update on the latest events, actions, and initiatives promoting equity, justice, and change across our community. The calendar's mission is to connect you with the heartbeat of grassroots activism in the DMV. Each week, we'll spotlight rallies, workshops, forums, and community actions happening across the region. If you have an event to share, submissions can be emailed to socialjustice@wpfw.org. Please include the name, date, and address of said event